Othello, it's the words and music associated with the kiss, un bacio, the kiss that symbolizes Othello's love for Desdemona, who is, after all, his salvation, and also associated with his murder of Desdemona, his downfall between Acts 1 and Act 4. Of course, terrible things transpire. And we'll hear this particular hinge theme, the one associated with the kiss, un bacio, in just a few minutes. In summary, then, Verdi was a traditionalist whose operas evolved to a level unparalleled in the 19th century. For more than 50 years, Verdi gradually refined every element in his dramaturgy: the parlante, the lyric aria and duet, the repetition of themes for purpose of reminiscence, and other elements as well. All of these elements are essentially in the classic tradition of opera, which began with Monteverdi. Verdi wrote 26 operas. All are serious except his second, that was the disaster Un Giorno di Regno of 1840, and his last, Falstaff of 1893. The characteristics of mature Verdi operas I would list as four essential characteristics. First, reliance on human emotions and psychological insight for the essential storyline of his operas, rather than mythology, rather than the supernatural, rather than heroes. He relies on human emotion and psychological insight. Two, increasing de-emphasis on bel canto divisions in favor of dramatic line and musical continuity. The third characteristic of mature Verdi operas, the orchestra plays a much more important role than the orchestra had ever played in Italian opera up to the time of Verdi. And fourthly, the fourth characteristic of mature Verdi operas, good libretti, my friends, at least good stories based on real literature. Verdi set stories that had originally been written by Schiller, by Victor Hugo, by Dumas, by Lord Byron, by Shakespeare. Othello, 1886, gestation. The story of Othello's gestation is a long and involved one, and to a degree we've got to get involved in it because it's fascinating, and it tells us lots about the time that it took Verdi to write this extraordinary opera. Following the premiere of Aida in 1871, Verdi, then 58 years old, retired from the opera stage. He hung up his compositional spurs, sat down in front of the fire. Actually, he was a very successful farmer, and said, enough. I've done enough. When his friend, the Countess Maffei, suggested that Verdi had a duty to write more, he replied, quote, are you serious about my moral obligation to compose? No, no, no. For you know well as I that that account is settled. Unquote. However, four people very close to Verdi did not believe his opera account was closed at all. They were Giuseppina Strepponi, his wife, his publisher, Tito Ricordi, the composer-conductor, Franco Faccio, and the composer-librettist, Arrigo Boito. Boito's dates are 1842 to 1918. Boito wrote his extraordinary opera, Mephistopheles, when he was only 26 years old. And then, my friends, he suffered the worst case of writer's block in the history of the musical world. He continued to work on his second opera for the next 50 years, leaving it incomplete at his death. Now, in 1862, many years before Verdi's retirement, Boito, then a brilliant and gifted 21-year-old musician, writer, and gadfly, and someone who Verdi knew fairly well, had, in one of those ignorant and youthful moments we all regret, called Verdi, quote, an idiotic old man who urinated on the altar of art, unquote. This was a fit of Wagnerism that passed rather rapidly. What did not pass was Verdi's anger. Verdi, of course, was deeply offended and thereafter refused ever to see Boito again, despite the fact that in following years, Boito became a great fan of Verdi's. Anyway, In July of 1879, 8 years after the premiere of Aida, Verdi's wife, publisher, and the conductor Franco Faccio conspired to bring Verdi together with Boito after this 17-year estrangement. Eric Plaut picks up the tale. Boito was undoubtedly in on the plot, for within 3 days of the meeting, he presented Verdi with an outline for a proposed opera on Shakespeare's Otello. Verdi had been a proud, touchy, and stubborn man his entire life. He was now almost 66 years old, and age had not yet mellowed him. He liked the scenario for the opera that Boito showed him, but he would not commit himself to writing the music and refused to meet further with Boito to discuss it. Instead, he suggested that Boito complete the libretto and mail it to him for his later consideration. This was done in November of 1879, but Verdi did nothing for 8 months. And when he began work on it the next year, the collaboration did not go smoothly. Now I will make a long story short. The opera was not completed until 1886, 7 years after the first meeting with Boito. By the time the opera was completed, Verdi was 73 years old. All right, a few words about this most extraordinary libretto. The 19th century, and Verdi in particular, was fascinated by Shakespeare. Shakespeare's extraordinary insights into human attitudes, the human condition, and human relationships made his plays natural vehicles for the expression-crazed operas of the Romantic era of the 19th century. Dozens and dozens of operas would seem to have been based on Shakespeare's plays. Now, only a few of them survive today. For example, Berlioz's Beatrice and Benedict, which is based on Much Ado About Nothing. Rossini wrote an Otello. Bellini's I Capuleti e I Montecchi, the Capulets and the Montagues, obviously a Romeo and Juliet opera. Thomas's Hamlet. Gounod also wrote a Romeo and Juliet. Nicolai's Merry Wives of Windsor, and so forth. None of these operas can hold a candle to the three great operas based on Shakespeare that Verdi created: Macbeth, Otello, and Falstaff. Boito's libretto is a masterpiece of reduction and distillation, and one reason, of course, why Falstaff and Otello are such profoundly good operas is because Verdi had profoundly good libretti to work with. Boito wrote these last two libretti for Verdi, and they're both based, of course, on Shakespearean plays. Boito's Otello libretto has been called by many the best libretto of the 19th century, and I, for one, would not trifle with that statement. Boito reduces Shakespeare's five-act play to a four-act libretto. He eliminates the first act of Shakespeare's play, which takes place in Venice. And so the last four acts of Shakespeare's play, like all four acts of Verdi's Otello, all take place on the frontier island of Cyprus. In the process of reduction, and please, again, a word, a libretto is a very different creature. I've mentioned this earlier in the course, but it behooves me to bring it up again. A libretto is not just a play that you hand to a composer and say, set this to music. A libretto has to be a streamlined play. It has to be a play where everything is essential and nothing is extra, because when you add music to words, you lengthen considerably the amount of time it takes to say those words. Let's face it, I could say lots of words very quickly, but if I sing them, I cannot. So we've got to remember that a libretto is a very special kind of play. An extremely streamlined one where every word has to count, where one cannot afford to keep going back over and over things, as I can afford to do here, for example. So in the act of adapting Shakespeare to a libretto, Boito has to do more than just cut out an act. He has to cut out a tremendous amount of character development, a tremendous amount of substance, a tremendous number of subsidiary scenes in order to cut to what he, Boito, believes is the essence of the story. So in the process of reduction, Boito seriously reduced the substance of Desdemona and made Otello and Iago somewhat less individual and more archetypical. But this shouldn't be a surprise. This is opera, and opera is archetypes. Boito's libretto is filled with religious imagery, iconography, and specifically Roman Catholic imagery that is only hinted at in the play. So in this way, the libretto is different than the play because it has much more religious imagery. Ultimately, as in any opera, it was up to Verdi to flesh out the characters and the dramatic situations. This he does, my friends, probably better than anyone else could have done. All right, the grand structure of the libretto, as I said, four acts. Act one, Otello as hero, Otello in control. And we will sample just enough of Act one to hear two aspects of Otello as hero. First, we will hear his heroic entrance, and we will become aware of him as the person in control. Secondly, we will become aware of Otello as lover and his wonderful and touching relationship with the much younger Desdemona. So we will sample just enough of Act one to understand Otello as hero and Otello as husband. Act two, Otello in doubt. Yes, the seeds of chaos are planted. We will listen to just enough of Act two to hear what Iago does to poison Otello and to witness Otello's reaction to that poison. We're only going to hear about 25% of Act two. So it might seem in the course of our listening that Otello is way overreacting, that he's going off the deep end much too rapidly. But that's because I'm not playing you enough. I'm just trying to give you a sense as we go of what Iago does to manipulate Otello into feeling that Desdemona is not true and how Verdi portrays this musically. Act three represents Otello's degradation. The chaotic elements grow, and we will hear nothing from Act three. Act four, Otello's destruction, his fall from grace, his embrace of chaos, and of course, the death of Desdemona, and ultimately, Otello's horribly won self-awareness. Time permitting, we will listen to a brief portion of the fourth act. Three main characters, as in the libretto. Now I'm referring strictly to Boito's libretto, not to Shakespeare's play. Two of these three main characters in the libretto represent polar opposites. They are Desdemona, Otello's wife. You'll excuse me, I'm going to use the Italian pronunciations because I'm used to hearing the opera. Instead of Desdemona, I might slip, but instead of Desdemona, I'm going to try to keep saying Desdemona. And instead of saying Othello, I'm going to try to keep saying Otello, because this is how we will hear their names in performance of the opera. In any case, two polar opposites among our three main characters. Desdemona, Otello's wife, represents pure good. She represents order. She represents Christian purity and an almost Christ-like desire for self-sacrifice. All right, at the other extreme is Iago, Otello's sergeant, and perhaps Otello's wannabe wife. I, for one, and maybe I'm reading too much into this because I'm a late 20th century person, but I, for one, detect a terrific amount of homosexual implications in this extraordinary libretto by Boito. And since Boito is smarter and more talented than I, I'm assuming that if I see it, it's probably there in much greater detail than I even recognize. In any case, Iago represents pure evil. He represents chaos. He is the Antichrist, an almost satanic creation. The action, oh, by the way, before I go on, I would tell you that the original working title of this opera was not Otello. The working title was Iago. Iago was the central figure originally. The action of both the opera and the play traces Otello's journey from Desdemona, from control, from good, to evil, to the side of Iago, from control to chaos. By the way, the beauty of having the great bulk of the play and all of the opera take place on the frontier island of Cyprus is as follows. Venice represents civility. It represents non-barbarity. It represents culture. But the barbaric frontier island of Cyprus, where civilization does not exist, of course, provides the perfect atmosphere for Otello's descent into barbarity. So Venice versus Cyprus represent the difference between Desdemona and control and Iago and chaos, between civility and barbarity. All right, Otello, the third, of course, of our main characters, is the man in the middle. His skin color is not, as some have suggested, a metaphor for potential darkness of character. Please, his skin color is a metaphor for alienation. Otello is, among the Italians, an outsider, a stranger in a strange land, a man without strong cultural ethnic roots, and therefore a man susceptible to change. Early in Otello's life, he suffered the brutality of slavery and chaos. Through the force of his own personality, through the force of his own will, his life has become civil and ordered. Otello contains within him, then, the seeds of order and chaos, of civility and brutality, of self-confidence and profound doubt. Otello, my friends, is every person. His doubt is our doubt. His destruction, our destruction. His ultimate self-awareness is our own. Samuel Johnson, describing the universality of Shakespeare's characters, wrote that Shakespeare is, quote, "the poet that holds up to his readers a faithful mirror, because his characters are not modified by the customs of particular places, but act and speak by the influence of those general passions and principles by which all minds are agitated." So Johnson is recognizing the archetypical characteristics of Shakespeare's characters, how we are meant to identify with them, how they so much echo our own fears, our own beliefs, our own actions. Of his opera, Otello, Verdi wrote, "My opera is a drama of passion, not a spectacle. It is almost an intimate drama. I even intend to reduce the size of the La Scala stage for the last act. I fear that the opera stage will be too vast for Otello." So again, Verdi is looking for intimacy, human drama, the relationships, the development of emotion, more than any other aspect to define his opera, his version of this Shakespearean tale. All right, let us begin with the vast opening. In the time we have left in this lecture, I will tell you about this incredible heroic opening, and then at the beginning of our next lecture, we will have an opportunity to listen to it. Otello, Act One. Otello as hero, Otello as husband. Opening, let me set the scene. A town in Cyprus, outside the castle. We see an inn with a trellised arbor. In the background, the quayside and the sea. It is evening, and a terrible thunderstorm rages. My friends, there is no overture. In a stupendous and awe-inspiring moment, the storm explodes from the orchestra. This violent storm offers us a double metaphor. It presages the coming storm in Otello's own heart and his terrific recklessness, and the storm also represents the chaos that arrival in Cyprus represents. The civility of the Italian peninsula is a thing of the past, and the first thing we're faced with in this opera is chaos, a storm, and a violent one. Note, please, even as this initial explosion quiets, we're going to hear a rumbling three-note chromatic cluster, because they're three notes adjacent to each other, played in the organ at the very bottom of the organ's range. These three notes. This cluster and the uneasy feeling it gives us will be sustained nonstop, continuously, for 255 measures. For 6.5 minutes, no matter what else happens in the music, we will hear this underneath it. Oh, is that going to make everything seem indefinite and unhappy? All right, the action begins. A flash of lightning, portrayed, by the way, by piccolos, flutes, and oboe, reveals an approaching ship to those gathered ashore, and a chorus of Cypriots is gathered before us. Successive lightning strokes reveal a standard with the Lion of Venice on it. This is Otello's ship, hoving through the waves, hoping for the safety of the harbor. and the Cypriots yell, "A sail, a sail, a standard, a standard!" Montano, governor of the island, says, "'Tis the winged lion!" And Cassio, standing next to Montano, Cassio is Otello's number two man. Now the lightning flash reveals it. Yes, the ship signals the shore, first with a fanfare and then with a cannon blast. Kaboom! We hear it in the opera. Newcomers, another group of people on stage, yell, a fanfare, and then everyone together, the cannon has roared. Cassio, 'tis the general's ship. Montano, now she is engulfed, now she is tossed skywards. And we hear these extraordinary orchestral accompaniment, which depicts the ship laboring in these heavy seas. Cassio, her prow rises from the waves, and then some more Cypriots yell, she is shrouded in the clouds of the sea. Indeed, a dark and malevolent spirit seems to boil upwards from the violent sea. Of course, it boils upwards from a violent orchestra. And again, I would point out the extraordinary role of the orchestra in creating the scene, in creating a musical and the visual environment that goes along with the screaming of these crowds and individual singers. The crowd says, and anon appears in the lightning flash, and then everyone, lightning, thunder, whirlpools, tempestuous storms, and thunderbolts. The waves quake, the winds quake, the depths and the heights quake. A new and even more violent passage erupts in the chorus and in the orchestra. For me, at this point, the music transcends that of a storm and becomes the representation of a spiritual and religious cataclysm, foreshadowing again Otello's cataclysmic loss of faith and his subsequent destruction. Everyone screams. A grim and blind spirit, dizzily plunging, cleaves the air. God shakes the wild heaven, dark as a pall. All is smoke. All is fire. The horrid darkness becomes a conflagration, then dies out more baleful still. The universe is smitten. The spectral north wind comes rushing. Titanic trumpets resound in the sky. And, of course, the very brass of hell breaks forth from the sea. This whole narration, of course, has just told us the story of the opera. It just told us the story of what will happen to Otello himself. Trumpets are heard. Women of the island come running in and look towards the quay. They scream, God from the glare of the tempest, God from the lure of the sandbank. The opening storm scene reaches its climax with this impassioned prayer from the gathered throng. We hear a huge, dark, sustained prayer in the key of A minor. Save the ship and the flag of Venetian fortune, thou who rulest the stars and fate, thou who commandest earth and heaven, in the depths of a calmed sea, bring the trusty anchor to rest. And then we meet at this moment Iago standing there, scowling. Her mainsails burst, and Rodrigo, Iago's dupe. Her bow is rushing full on that rock. The Cypriots yell, help, help. And Iago says, may the raging belly of the sea be her tomb. His evil malevolence is clear from the beginning. But even while Iago hopes for disaster, the ship enters the safety of the harbor. She is saved! She is saved! Cry the Cypriots. Lower the boats, all hands to the ropes. Make fast. Pull together. To the shore. To the landing. Disembark. Hurrah! 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 Eviva! 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 Otello enters, ascending the steps from the shore to the quay, followed by Venetian soldiers and sailors. And in one of the most magnificent entries in the whole history of opera, Otello sings, rejoice! The Mussulman's pride is buried in the sea. Ours and heaven's is the glory. After our arms, the storm defeated him. Yes, the storm, chaos, has sunk the Turkish fleet, but it could not yet sink Otello. His triumph is a triumph over the very elements of nature. Otello's solo here goes far beyond the mere announcement of the Turkish defeat and their pride laid low. It places Otello upon a peak of power and sublimity from which his descent will be all the more terrifying. The Cypriots cry, long live Otello! Hurrah! 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 Victory! 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 They are defeated, dispersed, destroyed, engulfed, buried in the terrible depths. For their requiem, they will have the lash of the breakers, the brawl of the whirlwind, the abyss of the sea. Vittoria! 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 Dispersed, destroyed, engulfed, buried in the terrible depths. Victory! Victory! The storm finally begins to die away, and the chorus says the storm is subsiding. Finally, indeed, the storm dies. Lightning flickers, distant winds quiet. The long-sustained organ cluster finally subsides. I've taken us to the edge, my friends. When we come back, we will listen to this extraordinary opening, explosive, chaotic, but ultimately controlled by Otello's heroic entry. Let's take our break. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 21, the third of four lectures entitled Giuseppe Verdi and Otello. Now, at the end of the last lecture, we came to the brink, to the very edge, and now we are prepared to listen to this incredible opening 6.5 minutes of this opera. There's nothing else like it in all of our operatic repertoire. Again, to quickly recap what we will hear. The opera begins with a terrific and terrifying storm that is a metaphorical storm, a metaphor for the entrance into chaos, which is what Cyprus represents, and a metaphor for the coming chaos in Otello's own heart. This chaos is represented by an explosive orchestra, by screaming chorus as they watch Otello's ship attempt to come into the harbor after destroying the Turkish fleet. But now Otello himself could be destroyed by the forces of nature. Ultimately, Otello, here in the first act, is not destroyed by the forces of nature. He is still in control. And his heroic and magnificent entrance does not just denote the entrance of a victor, but also denotes the entrance of someone who can control and dominate the chaos as represented by the storm. Here in the first act, we are witness to Otello, hero, Otello, husband. His downfall will be all that more terrifying, having seen him at the sublime height of his powers here in the first act. After he declares victory over the Moors, the crowd, the Cypriots, these many choruses that have been assembled on stage celebrate a magnificent victory. Here's what I want you to be aware of in terms of the performing forces. Verdi's management of this amazing variety. We will hear soloists. We hear Montano, we hear Cassio, we hear Iago, we hear Rodrigo, we hear Otello. We will hear groups of choruses, a chorus of women, a chorus of men, choruses of sailors, all interacting, singing singly, and also singing together. And of course, the mammoth orchestra featuring even a pipe organ playing those low, rumbling notes. Huge management of huge forces. Verdi does this really as well as can be done. So as we listen to this dramatic opening, let's be aware that it is metaphoric for much that will come, and let's be aware of Verdi's management of his musical forces.
Il nostro Madonna, nella luce della
incredible. There is nothing else like it in all of opera. All right, immediately after this opening, we get to meet Iago and his henchman and dupe, Roderigo. Roderigo loves the young, beautiful, and blonde Desdemona. Her recent marriage to the 45-ish black former slave Otello has enraged him beyond all reason. Iago will play Roderigo like a harp, or should we say he'll play him like a Casio, if you'll excuse me. All right, in this quasi-recitative, Iago's villainous personality emerges clearly, casual, friendly, and completely malignant. Please also note Iago's scornful, derisive, mocking little ariosos at any mention of women. Boito's libretto is already very negative when it comes to Iago's feelings about women, and then Verdi takes that and accentuates it terrifically by giving these derisive little sing-songy lines to Iago whenever he mentions the ladies. Iago turns to Roderigo and says, "Well, Roderigo, what are you thinking? You know, penny for your thoughts?" Roderigo, "Of drowning myself," as opposed to Otello, who didn't drown. Iago, "Fool is he who drowns himself for love of woman." Roderigo, "How to win, I know not." So Iago responds, "Come now, be sensible. Await the working of time. To the lovely Desdemona, whom in your secret dreams you adore, the dark kisses of that thick-lipped savage will soon turn loathsome. Good Roderigo, your sincere friend, I do profess me. Nor could I serve you with greater zeal." Oh, Iago's racist description of Otello, followed by his false proclamation of friendship, reveal him to be dangerous and loathsome. And in a nasty, almost mocking little tune, Iago shows himself to be no great fan of womanhood. "If a woman's weak vow prove not too difficult a knot for my talent, nor yet for hell, I swear this lady shall be yours. Listen, although I feign to love him, I hate the Moor." Iago points to Cassio and continues speaking. "There is the reason for my hate. Look, yonder, that foppish captain usurps my rank, the rank that in 100 well-fought battles I have earned. Such was Otello's will, and I remain of my Moorish lord his ensign. But as true 'tis you are Roderigo, so too 'tis true that, were I the Moor, I would not wish to see a Iago about me. But if you hear me," and at this point, Iago leads Roderigo to the side and starts explaining his plan of action. Please, let's listen to this recitative / arioso section. We are well introduced to Iago's duplicitous villainy right here. And please notice these sing-songy little ariosos every time he mentions women or Desdemona. They are mocking and very cruel in their sound.
Roderigo, e ben che pensi
affogarmi?
Stolto è chi s'affoga per amor di donna.
Vincer mezzo.
Su via, facendo, aspetta l'opra del tempo. Ad estremo la bella, che nel segreto dei tuoi sogni adori, presto in occia verranno i foschi baci di quel selvaggio dal mi gonfie l'aria. Buon Roderigo, amico tuo sincero, mi ti professo, nei più forti ambascia soccorrer ti potresti. Un fragil poco di femmina non è troppo, vado per genio mio re per l'inferno. Giuro che quella donna sarà tua. Ma ascolta, ben che finga d'amarlo, odio quell'ora, è una cagion dell'ira, eccola,
guarda. Quell'azzimato capitano usurpa il grado mio, il grado mio, e il cento ben curiate battaglio meritato. Tal fu il voler d'Otello, e io rimando di suo amore scassi. Così è pur vero che se morio fossi, fermi non vorrei d'attorniano. Se tu m'ascolti.
Oh yes, oh yes, this is a dangerous man. I think we agree with Iago on one point. None of us wants to have a Iago around us. Now, might I suggest that Iago feels betrayed for two reasons. First, there's the obvious one, the one that he stated just now. He's been passed over for promotion in favor of the young, inexperienced Florentine, Michael Cassio. Now, if Iago is really the sergeant with all this battle experience, then probably Otello should have promoted him. But Otello has instead promoted the younger, pretty, highly educated, preppy Michael Cassio, and this rankles deeply, and it might very well be an error on Otello's part to have promoted Cassio past Iago. Perhaps Otello, wishing to ingratiate himself with a class of person that he never thought he would have associated with, is seeking, through his own favors, to garner their affection in return. Who knows? But we do know that Iago is furious to be passed over for this promotion, particularly given that Cassio got it. But in the arcane workings of his malevolent mind, might I also suggest that Iago feels he's been passed over in love by Otello, who has just married Desdemona. Now, why the wedding? Why the whole big fuss about Desdemona just having married Otello if it isn't an intrinsic part of Iago's fury? It is part of Iago's fury, because Iago is going to seek revenge not just on Otello, but on Cassio and Desdemona as well. All three of them must be destroyed to satisfy Iago's anger. And it tells us much about Iago, at least on the inside, because it's nothing he ever admits to. He must destroy her as well as Otello. Now, the character of Iago held a special fascination for Verdi. Even before he began composing this opera, he described to one of his friends, the painter Domenico Morelli, how he himself, Verdi, would play Iago if he were an actor. And now I quote Verdi: "I would have a long, thin face, thin lips, small eyes, close to the nose, as monkeys have, a high, receding forehead with the back of the head well developed. His manner would be absent-minded, nonchalant, indifferent about everything, skeptical, bantering, and he would say both good and evil things lightly, as if he were thinking about something completely different than what he was saying. So that if anyone were to reprove him and say, 'What you're saying or what you're doing is monstrous,' he could say perfectly well in response, 'Really, I didn't see it that way. Oh, let's say no more of it then.' A fellow like that might deceive everybody, even his own wife." Iago's plot begins to take shape almost immediately. During the victory party that follows Iago's and Roderigo's dialogue, what we just heard, Iago succeeds in getting Michael Cassio drunk. It's a wonderful moment, this come wet your whistle. Cassio says, "I already had some wine before and I'm not a good drinker." Immediately, a soldier, a second in command who's not a good drinker, we become aware as an audience right away that this guy is certainly not one of the boys on the front. In any case, they ply him with more wine and he gets drunk very quickly. The crowd starts laughing at this drunken soldier. He gets very hot under the collar. And then Iago manages to provoke an argument between Cassio and Roderigo, knowing that both have been in love with Otello's wife, Desdemona, before she married the Moor. Montano, the former governor of Cyprus, who's just been replaced by Otello, intervenes in the fight between Cassio and Roderigo and is attacked and wounded by the drunken Cassio. And this is exactly what Iago wanted to happen. Bedlam ensues, another storm, this one engineered by Iago. Completely in control of the situation, Iago now instructs Roderigo, while the duel between Cassio and Montano is in progress, to spread confusion in the harbor. Yes, Iago says this: go to the harbor with all the speed you can muster, crying, "Revolt! Revolt! Go! Spread confusion and horror. Let the bell sound in alarm." The sense of storm and impending doom are reinforced by a powerfully descending chromatic bass line. Very deathly, the kind of music ordinarily associated with death and disgrace. This entire passage is a brilliant compositional tour de force. We hear a rising crescendo accompanied by extraordinary motivic development, the kind of stuff Beethoven would have been proud to call his own. Roderigo runs off. Iago turns to the two fighting men. "Brothers, stop this cruel fight." Yes, as if he doesn't know who initiated it. And the Cypriot women yell, "Let's flee, let's flee." Iago, "Heavens, Montano's dripping with blood. What a furious fight." And again, the women say, "Let us flee, let us flee." Iago yells, "Truce." Ha, look who's calling for a truce. And the men yell, "Truce." The women yell, "They're killing one another." The men yell, "Peace." And Iago says, "No one can longer restrain this fighting fury. Raise the alarm. Satan possesses them." Yes, Satan does possess them. We hear a long vocal and orchestral series of descents which accompany Iago's call for the alarm to be raised. This is the second storm alarm of this long and eventful day. The Cypriots scream, "To arms, to arms, help, help." The tumult reaches its frenzied climax when enter Otello, and he cuts through the noise like a blade through soft butter, and he yells, "Abbasso le spade! Down with your swords!" It stops on a dime. The combatants turn to him. Montano staggers back, wounded, and there is silence. Then ferocious chords and upward strings reflect Otello's fury and his authority. And he says, "How now? What is happening? Am I among Saracens? Have you turned Turks so that you tear one another to pieces? Honest Iago, by the love which you bear me, speak." Because Iago's been standing there as if he had nothing to do with this. Iago's slimy, lying reply is a masterpiece of duplicity. "I know not. E'en now all here were friends, civil and merry, but on a sudden, as if some malign star had bewitched their judgment, unsheathing their swords, they fell upon one another. Would I lost my legs ere they had borne me here." Yeah, right. I'm so unhappy, I'd rather have lost my legs than to see this happen. Please, let's listen to this second storm. Let's listen to this second time that Otello puts an end to the storm, this marvelous and extraordinary entry. But let's also be aware that the plot is now afoot and Iago is assuming control.
Sbranarvi l'un l'altro. Onesto io. Non so qui tutti eran cortesi amici di arte giocondi, ma ad un tratto come se un pianeta maligno avesse quelli svagato il segno, squainando l'arme s'avventano furenti. Avessi io prima stronta di me che qui madusse.
Well, Iago is coming out on top, because Othello is enraged. He rashly, he recklessly strips Cassio of his rank in front of everybody without even a proper inquiry, just with this statement from Iago. Iago gloats. Othello has overcome another storm, but at a very high price, my friends, at the price of a friend and an ally. Cassio now recedes into the background. This is the last storm that Othello will be victorious over. What follows this scene is the incandescently beautiful love duet between Othello and Desdemona, which concludes Act One. Now, dramatically and emotionally, this duet must unite two very different characters. Othello, well past the age of 40, commanding and experienced, and Desdemona, young, inexperienced, and impulsive. I might also add very quickly this. In Shakespeare's five-act play of Othello, as I mentioned before, the first act takes place in Venice, and we get to meet the characters and find out who they are. We meet Desdemona in Venice, and she is a powerful and strong young woman who tells her father, I love this man, and I want to be married to him, and my duty is now to him, despite the fact that her father does not want her to marry Othello. So our impressions of Desdemona in the first act of Shakespeare's Othello is of a very powerful personality. Now, without Act One here in the opera, we have no impression of Desdemona whatsoever so far. She's just this cute blonde running around the stage. And so this love duet does more than just establish the love between Desdemona and Othello. It has to establish her as a character as well. She has to start gaining some substance other than being simply an object of men's desire or derision. So it's something we should be very aware of. She is not as important a character up to this point in the opera as she would have been up to this point in the play. During the course of the duet, it stands revealed that Desdemona's love was nothing less than Othello's spiritual and emotional salvation. We're just going to hear a couple of quick passages from the love duet. In the following passage, which, by the way, is of sublime and infinite beauty, Othello and Desdemona confess to that which inspired their love for one another. Othello says, Your lovely face ennobled the story of my life with tears, and your lips with sighs. On my darkness glory descended, paradise and the stars to bless. Desdemona responds, And from your dusky temples I saw the eternal beauty of your spirit shine. Othello, And you loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved you that you did pity them. And Desdemona responds, And I loved you for the dangers you had passed, and you loved me that I did pity them. And then they sing those same lines together. Let us listen to this portion of the love duet, and let's listen to the unbelievable lyricism that marries these people together better than any words possibly could.
Oh!
we must jump forward to the conclusion of this amazing duet, which reaches its glorious and transcendental emotional climax with the kiss. It's a moment of joining, of consummation, and it is depicted again with unearthly beauty. Othello says, a kiss, and Desdemona says, Otello. And Otello says, a kiss, and yet another kiss. Now, this kiss music will become one of these Verdian hinge themes, which will return with agonizing power at the end of the opera, when it equals, literally, a kiss of death. Othello says, the burning Pleiades already sink into the sea. Desdemona says, late is the night. Othello counters, come, Venus, the goddess of love, shines on high. Desdemona says simply, Othello. They go slowly towards the castle, clasped in each other's arms. Let us listen, and please let us think. This is the Othello and Desdemona we wish we could remember.
Joy!